It's completely pitch black now. I've got the head torch on. There were these big, big dens. Like, they weren't fox dens. They were wild dog dens. I could see prints just visually as I was running past it. All I've got is my headlamp, which I can swing like a bomby knocker, and the phone, Michael's phone. I'm like, I am so screwed. If I come across a pack of wild dogs and they want to get me, I am so screwed.
I hunt animals in the pursuit of life. Life lived and life taken. I believe it's through this dance with nature and the wild places that we truly live, connect, and grow. I'm Chris Waters, the Huntsman, and these are my stories.
Hey everybody, thank you for joining me for another episode of the Huntsman Podcast. This is going to be another solo conversation. I don't have a guest for this evening. What I wanted actually to do is have a discussion and talk about what's been happening with season two and go over some of the reflections that I've had now that we've filmed episode one and two, and we'll be heading out to film episode three and four in the next week or so. Recently, I've been thinking about authenticity and the importance of authenticity, and reminded of how podcasts are a really good long form experiment, I guess is what you could say, in bringing out authenticity. And so I wanted to kind of lean into that and give you some behind the scenes looks at what has been happening with the season, some of the frustrations that I've had, some of the challenges that we've had, some of the lessons and the learning that we've had, and some cool stories as well that have come out of it too, because there's been some pretty funny stories. Maybe I'll start with the stories because they're fun, right? So the first story is during episode one, which was in central New South Wales. The original plan was to fly out there, and I was hunting with my friend Geordie, who was coming up from Victoria with me, and our cameraman, Jesse Ray, from Victoria as well. And we would meet Dodge we basically fly and meet him at the airport in Sydney and then drive to the location. We realized that we wouldn't have enough room in the car. And so that kind of threw the whole flying thing out the window, because the show is really on a tight budget. It's hard to describe how expensive this show is, even when you're doing it on a tight budget. So you have to be really, really careful that you manage and maintain the budget. And it sounds crazy and ridiculous, but renting a car would have blown the budget, another car, to have two cars. So we couldn't do that. So Joy came up with the idea. He's like, let's just drive out there. And, you know, it's 10 and a half hours from Victoria. Let's just do that. And so we're like, yeah, sure. Let's just do that. So that's what we were planning on doing. We would leave on the Thursday night at like 12:01 a.m. And myself and Geordie and our cameraman would then drive up to New South Wales to do this hunting and filming. And the actual travel there was perfect. It was fine. We didn't have any issues at all. At the last minute, Geordie had to change cars because his car died. He had to borrow a friend's car. And he was like, is that okay? I'm like, oh, I've got so much to organize. Anything you can take off my plate is good. I really don't mind, whatever. And so we used his car and it was fine. It's like a people mover. It was like a wagon, like a family wagon. And anyway, we were fine all the way up there. And then on the way back is when things started to go wrong. So we'd been hunting and filming for a number of days, and I was exhausted. I think everyone was actually exhausted. It was a pretty emotional trip, which I'll talk about later in this podcast episode. But it was pretty full on, and we were all ready to come home. We felt like we'd accomplished what we'd accomplished. We had a lot of fun during that process, but Jesse Ray has a partner, as does Geordie. I have a wife and kids. We were ready to get home to our families, and we had a 10 and a half hour drive ahead of us to go do that. So we left Dodge in the morning of the final day and started driving out, got through, there's like a fairly dense wilderness area full of rabbit warren roads to get out of the location that we had to kind of navigate through and figure out our way through. And we finally got to the first town, which is about, I'm going to say about 40 minutes from the location. And we'd actually passed through this town on the way up to where we were hunting. And I remember it because we walked into the gas station and this is such a classic Australian small country town phenomena that I'm going to describe now. There's this handwritten letter like stuck to the counter. No attendant there, just a letter that says, there's a loose snake somewhere in the store, but don't worry, it won't hurt you, or something like that. Something ridiculous. Anyway, so we're driving back. We get to this town, and the idea was that we were going to have a toilet break and buy some coffee because, like, we, you know, hadn't used a really nice toilet for a bunch of days, and we were, you know, craving a really nice coffee. And so we'll go do that, and then we'll, you know, hit the road, drive back to Victoria, and. I remember just as we were pulling into this little gas station / cafe, the temperature gauge on the car just skyrocketed. It went from like zero to like off the charts. And then Geordie was like, "Ooh, that's not good." And we parked the car and turned off the engine, and you could hear the coolant in the engine bubbling. It's like blah, 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 blah. And then I took one look at Geordie. I'm like, that is not. I mean, I'm not a mechanic. My dad was a mechanic for something like 30 or 40 years before he retired. So I've been around cars all my life, but I distinctly don't like cars. And I knew that that was a bad sound. So we pulled up and we thought, let's just open up, you know, the bonnet, give the car a bit of breathing space, let it cool down. We'll go get our coffee. We'll go to the toilet. We'll come back and we'll be fine. Like, you know, I'm ever the optimist. So I'm like, this is fine. We're good. We can do this. Anyway, we go, we get our coffees, go to the toilet. We come back and the temperature's gone down. We're like, okay, it's still like, you can still feel the heat coming off the engine. I'm like, but it will be fine. So we all hop in the car and we drive 5 minutes out of the town, and that temperature gauge spikes again, skyrockets. And then Geordie starts losing power to the engine from the engine. And we just look, this is like a look of dread as we look at each other, and we pull over and we're all thinking the worst. We're like, we've got 9.5 hours drive home. We're all stuffed. We're all tired. Our partners are expecting us. Like, I'm, you know, it's when you go out hunting for a long period of time, hunters, you'll know this if you're a hunter yourself. If you're new to hunting, this is something that you'll have to learn to navigate. But a big long trip requires a lot of work from your partner to pick up the slack when you're gone. And I actually get criticized sometimes by talking about this, because some people just think that your partner should just absorb all of that work to support you. And like, and it's like, you know what? I just love hunting, and I wouldn't be with that person if they didn't allow me to go hunting, and they just need to let me go whenever I need to go. And it's a very short, close-minded look at how it actually works. Me and my wife are a partnership, and so I support her, she supports me. And I'm conscious of when what I'm doing is creating a burden for her. Even though she's willing to carry that burden, I'm still mindful of the cost of that. And I want to minimize the cost of that so that I can go out hunting again, but also because I care for her and I want her to be okay. And so I was thinking about that. We're thinking about getting back to our partners. You know, Geordie's got work the next day, as I just arrived, so do I. So like, we've been away for a bunch of days. We need to get home. We really need to get home. And so we pull the car over and Geordie's like, don't worry, guys. It's all good. I wouldn't have borrowed this car if it didn't have full RACV cover insurance. Now, if you're outside of Australia and you don't know what RACV is, essentially it's like breakdown support that you can pay for. It's like insurance that if something happens, the RACV will come out to you. They'll fix your car. They'll tow you somewhere. They'll put you up in an accommodation. They'll give you a rent a car. There's a whole bunch of different options. But Geordie said, like, I wouldn't have borrowed this car if I didn't have the full, or if the person I borrowed it from didn't have the full level of insurance. So we all kind of had a sigh of relief. Like, okay, we're good. We're good. It's all good. It's good. And in my absolute ignorance and short-minded, extreme optimist brain mindset, I thought, you know what? It's fine. They'll just give us a rental car and we'll just drive all the way back to Victoria in a rental car. Or worst comes to worst, they'll tow us back to Victoria and we'll all have a sleep in the car. That's what I'm thinking in my pea brain. Anyway, Geordie calls the RACV. And the person's like, yep, I can confirm that you're covered. We'll send a mechanic over to have a look at the car and we'll do everything that we can to support you with your basic level of cover. And we all had a moment where we looked at each other and was like, did you say basic level of cover? Don't we have the full cover? And then the lady on the line was like, no, sorry, you don't have just the basic. I'm like, well, what does that entitle us to? Basically, what it entitles us to is a mechanic to come out, look at the car and tell us what we already knew, which is the mechanic. Here's what happens. The mechanic comes. We wait 40 minutes for the mechanic to come. He comes. He takes one look at the car and he says, your car is stuffed. It's done. It's not just like not going to run. It's never going to run again. You've blown the head gasket. You've ruined the engine. It's not going to go. It's finished. And so we all look at each other and think, well, what are our options? And he said, look, I can call my friend who will tow you an hour back in the wrong direction and you'll have to pay for the tow. And then you can get the car fixed there and figure out what you got to do. Option one. Option two, I can, fill up. I've got, 5 liters of water in the car. I can fill up your car with water because you can use water rather than coolant if you need to get out of a bind. It's not ideal, but you can use it. And I can get you back to the town that you just came out of 5 minutes away. That was the two options. And so we're thinking, oh my gosh, this is so bad. This is such bad. Like, these are not good options. So like, let's just take option two for now and we'll see if we can get back to the town and then we'll figure out if we do the other option. So anyway, he fills up the car with 5 liters of water. It's still thirsty. It still wants more water, but he doesn't have any. And he said, at least you can go back to that gas station in the first town and buy some water if you need to. So he said to us though, I don't think, full disclosure, I don't think you can get back to that location. 5 minutes away. Your car is cooked. Anyway, we hop in the car. He tails us and we manage to get back to that little town. And we're all just going, oh my gosh, what do we do? What do we do? He waits at the car. I drive into the gas station. And the lady who served us when we were like going through the town on the way to the hunting trip is still there. There's a bucket next to her tipped upside down. And I took one look at the bucket. I'm like, is there a snake in there? And she's like, yeah, we caught the snake. I'm like, but it's still in there. And she's like, yeah, it's still in there. Someone hasn't come to pick up the snake. So there's a snake in a bucket. And I just say to the lady, I need water. Do you have like a slab of water I can buy? And she's like, I'm really sorry. I have like a bottle of water that you can buy. Like, 500, milliliters of water. And that's not going to cut it. And I see that she has these two 20 liter jerry cans. And I said, can I buy these? And is there water outside that I can fill up in? And she said, yeah, of course, honey. And so I think, thank goodness. So I bought these two jerry cans, filled them up. Now I've got 40 liters of water. Top up the rest of the car with maybe 5 more liters because it's still thirsty. It still wants more. And then we go to this mechanic and he's like, well, what do you want to do? Basically, your options are to get towed. I'm like, is there any other options? So it's like, is there another option that we can do? And he says, this is not my advice. This is not my professional advice. I don't recommend that you do this. But a madman could try and drive an hour that way towards Canberra, which we were already going that way. And if a madman tried to do that, they might get into the Canberra district which means if they broke down there, well, then they could get towed through their cover back to the depot in Canberra, which would give you options that you could then leave the car, fly out from Canberra Airport, or you could rent a car, because you can't rent a car in the location that we otherwise would have got towed to in the wrong direction. It's a small country town. But a madman, if so inclined, could try that. But that's not my advice. I wouldn't recommend that you do that. That's not my professional advice. And so we all look at each other and we're like, let's be madmen. And he said to us, there's no way, zero probability that that's going to work. There is zero probability that you're going to get 5 minutes down the road to where we were when we stopped. But we said thank you to the man, and we took our 40 liters of water, put it in the car, and I turned to Geordi and I said, Geordi, I know that you are not a man of faith, but I would really appreciate in this situation if you would pray with us. And Geordi was like, whatever, sure, whatever's going to get us home. And this is the only time I've ever done this in my whole entire life, but I literally hopped out of the car and I laid hands on the bonnet. I literally laid hands on the bonnet and I prayed over the car that God would get us home. And we started this harebrained madman plan to drive an hour to break down. It felt like we were refugees coming across from Papua New Guinea and hoping to get picked up by the Australian Navy. That's what it felt like. And we didn't even look at the speedometer. We were literally just staring at the temperature gauge, and it's an auto as well. And so we didn't, when we got to hills, we didn't like try and, you know, go the speed limit. We just thought whatever the car wants to do and not change gears, we're just going to cruise. We're just going to cruise. And if we can get an hour, then at least we can fly home, get home that night or late, really, really late that night. It's going to cost us a whole bunch of money, but we'll get home to our loved ones and we'll figure out the car another day. That was the plan. That was best case scenario. And, you know, 5 minutes pass and the temperature gauge hasn't moved. 10 minutes passed, still steady. Half an hour passes. We're starting to get hysterical. We're like madmen driving, just laughing. And I can't believe this is working. You know, we were not supposed to get 5 minutes down the road. 45 minutes, we're good, we're golden. An hour passes and now we're in the Canberra region. We're like, okay, we did it. We did the impossible, right? We managed to get to Canberra. And I just turned to Geordi and I said, we've got another 8.5 hours to go. I said, I think we can get home. Yeah. And this kind of like glimmer in my eye. And he's just like, there's no way, Chris. It's a miracle that we got an hour. Because we thought that what we would have to do is basically drive until it overheats, pull over, fill it full of water, drive until it overheats, and keep doing that until the car just would not drive because the engine was toast. But we got an hour, and he said, there's no way it's going to happen. But we hadn't filled it up once. The temperature gauge hadn't moved. I'm like, I think we can do it. And so we tried. We got all the way back home. The full 10.5 hours, and the temperature gauge did not budge an inch. It was a miracle. There's no other way to describe it. And I wish that we'd had got that RACV mechanic's phone number, because I could just imagine him going to the pub that evening, sitting down and sharing stories about what had happened that day with his mates and talking about these crazy Victorians who were going to try and risk their luck and get to Canberra. And then like you would hear like a bing, like a notification, he would lift up his phone and seen us like in Melbourne being like, ah, we got to Melbourne. It would have just been hilarious, but that was crazy. It was just absolute insanity that it actually worked and we got home. So that happened in episode one. And we were so emotionally taxed that I didn't film it. It was like survival mode. Something else that happened that was pretty fun and interesting and crazy, and you can actually watch some of this. We did actually film, but I'll expand upon the story now. You can actually watch it on the YouTube channel. If you go and check out the second episode, there's a link to the story that I'm about to talk about where there's an incident with the drone. But what had happened was that we were on the final day of filming, and what we tend to do on the final day of filming is kind of capture any little bits and bobs that we'd missed, or take some opportunities to film some environmental shots or sunsets and just nice stuff that we can't get when we're under the pump trying to get an animal. And so we planned on heading out on the final evening, and rather than doing a hunt, we were going to do a hunt as well, but we were going to film the sunset. And we were in this gorgeous area that was just, it was just absolutely beautiful. And Michael had told us about brumbies that were around the area and emus, and we hadn't had the opportunity to go see them because we were so busy filming. But I thought, wouldn't it be cool if we could? And so what we actually did was we were going to go capture this sunset and film it with the drone and capture like the car driving towards the sunset and some of the surrounding area. And we happened to see this brumby, and we're like, wow, isn't this cool? There's a brumby there. Let's go film that. And so we fly up the drone. Jesse Ray flies up the drone and he's filming this brumby. And the footage was like incredible. It's this giant black wild horse just being like majestic, incredible, running around, totally not fazed by the drone at all. Literally, like the drone is a meter from its face and it's just staring at the drone. Jesse Ray's doing circles around it. He's going up, he's going above it, he's coming down on it, just getting incredible footage of this brumby as we were waiting for like the golden hour of the sunset to come down. And we're all just like, this is so cool. This is such great content. We're having fun. We're seeing things. But we're burning battery, obviously, on the drone. So we better capture this sunset now. So he flies up and he starts capturing this sunset. And we're doing these maneuvers with the car to film the car kind of turning towards the sunset. And we're capturing all this great content. And I turn to Jesse Ray and I say, look, what's the battery life? Is it okay? Are we getting close to, the battery being depleted? Because we're flying pretty high. And going out pretty far. And he's like, no, we're good. And he looks down at the drone and realizes that he wasn't recording any of that content. None of the brumby, none of the car stuff that we were doing, none of the sunset stuff. And he freaks out. He's like, oh my gosh, I wasn't recording. And so he hits record on the device, and we only now have like sunset is happening. Like it's, and you've got this golden window with a sunset when you're filming to get it just right. Where if it's too low, it doesn't look as like kind of powerful and emotional and dynamic. And if the sun's too high and it hasn't kind of hit the skyline yet, the horizon, it just looks like super high exposed and it doesn't look good at all. So you've got this window of like a few minutes. And so we're like, quick, let's just quickly film that kind of sequence a few more times with the car. We filmed it once. We didn't capture it. We filmed it again. We captured it. It was beautiful. It's actually in, the sequence is actually in the video. And then Jesse Ray's like, I'm just going to fly the drone out and capture some of the awesome surrounding forest and property. And so he goes and does that. And he's getting pretty far and pretty high. And I'm worried about not just the sunset, but the battery life on the drone. And I'm like, Jesse Ray, maybe you should bring the drone back now. And he was like, no. I just want to capture as much as I can. As he says those words, the drone says, battery low, returning home, which is a safety feature that the drone has, like a protocol that it runs through, that if it knows how far away it is from the point of where it took off, that it will wait until the last moment and then it will kind of calculate the distance and then fly back based on the remaining battery life. So it says that. I mean, oh, that's not good. And in that point, you can't steer it. It's steering itself. And he's way out. The drone is way out. But Anyway, it says that. And then, no joke, a second later, it says connection lost. And the screen goes black. And we all look at each other. Myself, Michael, who's driving, Desiree, who's filming, essentially. And instant dread, because this is an expensive drone, right? And I'm worried about the drone. I'm worried about Jesse Ray. Anyway, so turn the car off. We all jump out. I'm just like listening for the drone. I'm hoping I hear like a sound as it flies back. Then we realize, I was like, wait a minute. We are not where we were when the drone took off. It's going to go back over there, which is about a couple hundred meters away. Like quickly, and it was actually off the side of the road, not on the road, but like in over a road in private property, and we had to get back there. And I'm worried, like, if this drone flies across the road and hits a car, or doesn't get all the way and lands on the road, that we could see a car coming down that road. We were freaking out. We drove all the way straight over there and it wasn't there. We still can't hear it and we're freaking out. And the battery life on the drone, you remember, is like, it's not just disconnection. It's not just like a connection lost. It's got no battery. It's like no battery at all. So our opportunity to connect with it and get information is you know, trickling away as well. And it's a relatively new drone as well. So Jesse Ray didn't fully know all of the features and functions of it. And I said to him, is there a way we can get like some sort of GPS reading on its last known location? He's like, I don't know. And he's flicking through it. And anyway, a second comes up, it says connection found. And it shows us a screenshot. And it's a screenshot of like a gum tree, like the base. It looked like a base of a dead gum tree. And where we'd been hunting was like private property where there's a few gum trees in and around the parts of the paddocks. But then there was a huge pine plantation, which is what we were flying over. And so I'm like, well, it's not in the pines. That's a good thing, because that was like kilometers of pines that would be just impossible to find it. I'm like, we're looking for the gum trees in the paddocks and the surrounding kind of, you know, I don't know, kilometer to see if it's, and we start hopping between those all the while worried about battery, all the while just always trying to figure out, you know, where. And I even took a picture of the screenshot of where, of what the remote was showing us of where it had crashed, in case that the battery died or it just lost connection again. Luckily I did, because it did lose connection. Anyway, we couldn't find it at any of the gum trees that we were looking around, and we're like about to lose hope. Like, it's, the sun is set, it's already dark, and it's about to get like dark, where you can't even see without a torch. And anyway, all of a sudden, Jesse Ray goes, I've got GPS coordinates. He figured out how to get GPS coordinates. And I turned to Michael and I grabbed Michael's phone and I said, quickly punch in these coordinates, because he was the only one that had reception, because we're in this remote area. Punch in these coordinates. Let's see where it drops the pin. It drops the pin something like 2 kilometers or something. I can't even remember. It was between 1 and 2 kilometers away from us into the wilderness, like just straight out into the wilderness, like up mountains into the wilderness. Into the bush, and I just took one look at the guys. I'm like, we are so stuffed. We are stuffed, because it might not even be at this GPS point, this GPS location. But I said, look, we just got to do it. So I grabbed a head torch and I grabbed the phone. I'm like, let's just go. We start running into the bush. And within like 20 meters, I say to the guys, are you guys good? Because I'm like running and they're lagging behind. And I turn and I look at them and they're both wearing flip-flops. They're both wearing like sandals and thongs. And I'm just like, oh my gosh. And I'm wearing my lower boots, my lower Rangers. And then I just said, look, give me the phone. I'm going to climb this mountain. If I'm not back in an hour, radio the guys, come looking for me. Because I'm could be completely lost. And I was like, so I'm just going to run hell for leather, just straight into this bush. And that's what I did. I just ran. I just had the phone in front of me and I was just running like this. Just running like a madman up a mountain. And it went from like this to this to like 45 degrees and I'm just running through the woods and I'm trying to stick to game trails because it's pretty thick timber. And I'm like, you know, the animals know how to get up these hills. As long as the game trail is kind of going in the direction that I roughly want it to go and going uphill, I'll follow it. So I'm following it. I got halfway, I got about 400, 500 meters, and I found these wild dog dens. They were like into the cliff face because at this point, I'm going up the end of a spur. So I'm climbing a mountain. And it's kind of embedded into this cliff face, these fallen boulders. And there were these big, big dens. Like they weren't fox dens. They were wild dog dens. And as I was running past them, I kind of slowed down and I checked the pads, like the areas of dirt in front of the entrances to each of these dens, because there was like five of them. And they're all like well used. Like I could see prints just visually as I was running past it. And I'm thinking, all I've got is my torch, my headlamp, which I can swing like a bomby knocker, and the phone, Michael's phone. I'm like, I am so screwed. If I come across a pack of wild dogs and they want to get me, I am so screwed. Anyway, I kept running. I kept climbing higher and higher and higher. And I get about 1,000 meters up this mountain. And it's completely pitch black now. I've got the head torch on and I get to the location where it says the drone is supposed to be. And I look in I was about like maybe 10, 20 meters off it. And I'm looking in the direction where it's saying the drone is supposed to be. And I can't see anything. And I'm really worried. And then I turn to my right because something caught my attention. And about 20 meters off, there's this red and green light that's flashing, going flat, on and off, on and off. And this is how much adrenaline was running through my brain, how spaced out I was and not thinking clearly. My first thought, weirdly, was, what is a game camera doing up on the side of the mountain? Even though game cameras don't flash like that, that was what my thought was. But my brain came to, and I was like, that's so dumb. And then my brain kind of just flipped and it was like, that's the drone, Chris. And so I ran over and I grabbed this drone and it's messed up. It's mangled. But I've got it. It's still got battery life. And I picked it up and in the footage, you can literally see like none of it is doctored. None of it is altered. I didn't know it was recording at the time. You literally see me find the drone, pick up the drone, carry the drone down the hill. And at this point, like I'm just giddy and I just know that I'm coming back as like the hero, right? Coming back to the guys with the drone recovered. I knew that Desiree had insurance on the drone, so that would be covered as long as we recovered it, which, you know, obviously we had. And so, like, I'm just enjoying, you know, the descent down this mountain and a really solid workout. And this gives you an insight into my brain and how it works in terms of, like, a creative and a marketing sense. As I was jogging down the hill, I'm thinking, this is such a good advertisement for Lower Boots. I was thinking, this is such a good promotion for their boots because there's no way I would have been able to get this drone in time had I not had these boots on, if I had flip-flops on. But these boots allowed me to get up the mountain comfortably, quickly, in time before the battery had completely died. If the battery on that drone had died and those flashing lights were dulled and off and there was no lights, I wouldn't have found it because it wasn't where it was supposed to be. And we had to leave the next day. And so we wouldn't have recovered that drone. That's the honest to God truth. It was so thick and so deep. And it was about 20 to 40 meters off the GPS to where the drone actually was. And so that we wouldn't have found it. It would have been lost. And I was thinking that as I was kind of descending from this mountain. And but then I thought, you know what? Don't film that because, like, you're just so, like, just focus on the task at hand. We got down the bottom and I gave it to Jesse Ray and he was so, like, he was worried. Like, he was very worried. He had lost all hope. Michael had lost all hope. They did not think that that the drone was going to be recovered. It was such a Hail Mary. And it just turns out that we recovered it and that we managed to get that footage off it, that it had saved, that we got that sunset, that we got that car maneuver. We didn't get, obviously, any of the Brumby, but we got all that. And the guys then wanted to, and then I mentioned that funny thing about like, hey, this would have made a great promo. And they're like, let's just film it. I'm like, I actually don't want to. And they're like, Chris, you just film it. If you don't want to use it, don't use it. And we ended up filming it, just a short little thing. And yeah, it was pretty funny. It was nice as well, actually, in hindsight, reflecting on it, to have the confidence. I've been hunting long enough now and doing enough wilderness stuff now to run up a mountain in the dark with just a patchy phone that have reception and be able to orienteer and orient myself well enough that I could comfortably come back. And it was nice just to, you know, be able to do that and not worry about getting lost or, losing my way, to do that confidently. That was pretty cool. So I'll give you some feedback, some thoughts, some reflections that I've done since recording these two episodes. And I alluded to it at the start of the episode. One of the things I've been thinking about is authenticity. And it's hard to describe how difficult it is to make a show like this, because you're dealing with so many competing dynamic systems. The weathers can be for you or against you. The hunting can be for you or against you. The technical kind of equipment can be for you or against you. And ideally, what you want to do, the best scenario, the best outcome is that you go there, that you film it, everything works perfectly, you have a great hunt, that there is a clear story, and that you just edit the whole thing chronologically and put it out, and it's just like awesome. And that happens a lot. In fact, that's happened, luckily, for both of these episodes. But that doesn't always happen, and you need to have backup plans for when you don't see animals, when you don't get the perfect shot, or you damage some equipment and lose some footage, or have to go back and re-record stuff, or all these different things. And it really makes the job of being... Not that it's not a job. It makes being authentic difficult. And then when you go and you're editing the videos later, and I play a large role in that, Jesse Rea, cameraman, is contracted to produce the first draft, which is a really quite a rough edit. And then I take it from there and I kind of polish it and take it to the final product. And usually these episodes take about 7 days, 9 to 5, to produce the video. And that's quick. That is, in terms of the video editing world, that's a very quick edit. Usually it takes a lot longer than that for most productions. But we're already, as we're filming it and we're thinking about the story, we're literally planning the story, we're planning the edit during the hunt in the evenings that follow the hunts during the day. And so we've got a pretty good idea of roughly what we want anyway and where the story's going. And so that takes out some of the work that we otherwise have to do. Plus, I think we're just good editors, to be honest. But there's a challenge as well when you're editing, especially when it comes to things like voiceovers. You want as many people as possible to see the work. And so you want your content to spread out. You want it to be viral for a few reasons. Because you value what you're doing, obviously, in a creative sense. And, you know, it's just nice when people see it. But when you have a purpose and a mission like I do, part of it getting it out there is about actually having an effect on the world, is wanting more and more people to get into hunting. And in order for them to do that, you need as many people to see the content as possible. And so there is this temptation then to be disingenuous and make things more extreme or more viral, or ramp up the intensity, or dial in more emotion, or there's a number of different tools that creators, you know, use to do this. But essentially, it's faking it. And there's a level of creative freedom that you can do that in a genuine way, by being, you know, by using different, like, music, for instance, to invoke a certain emotion, or choosing to bypass a section because you don't want it to have that emotional dip, or speeding up content or slowing down content, or just framing it in certain ways will affect the way that the person feels when they watch it. And so you can play with emotion and do that authentically, and then you can cross the line. And sometimes the line doesn't appear as solid as you might think and you might seem. Sometimes it gets a bit fuzzy. And it's something that I've battled with for a number of years to find that line, because ultimately I believe that being myself and be authentic is my greatest asset. And I want to do that for my own self, for my own values. But I also want to have an impact. And so I've tried to find the line, and I do have an apology to make, because I wasn't planning on apologizing in this video, but I think it's apt, because I think the voiceover for the introduction of episode one crossed that line, and it was subtle. I naturally have a fairly gravelly voice. I naturally have a flair for the dramatic. I can get passionate. All those things are true, but I felt like that introduction to the voiceover introduction to episode one was too gravelly and dramatic and over the top. And what was nice, what I really appreciated, was that a bunch of people gave me that feedback when they watched it. People who'd seen the episode prior, before it released to the public, and then people in the public who saw it and just thought, yeah, that was a bit much, Chris. And some of it was like, people are kind and they do it in love. Some people who I know really well just flat out said, that was off. And some people were a bit more diplomatic about the way that they told me, and they made a joke about it. Like, oh, that was a funny voice that you did and a bit gravelly, or you ate a bag of nails before you did that voiceover. But regardless of how people delivered it, the narrative was the same, in that that was too much. That was over the line. And it wasn't bad. It wasn't wrong. It wasn't deceitful. It wasn't authentic. It just wasn't real. And I really appreciate feedback, because I really appreciate growth. And if you want to grow, if you really value growth and learning and becoming a better person, then you have to appreciate feedback. I've always been someone that's responded well to tough love. That's not everyone. That's the kind of leadership that I had over me as I was developing. And so that naturally I tend to respond well to that kind of thing. But just feedback in general, it's really important that we remain open to that. And so I have kept myself sensitive to people that I trust, and to be honest, even sensitive to people that I don't trust, enough so that I get the messages through. Because you don't want to have like a wall up that stops all information from coming in, all feedback. But you don't want to accept it from every single corner of the globe as well. You need to be careful about it. But I had it from enough people that I thought it was over the line. And so I want to apologize for that introduction and for being disingenuous. That is not my intention. So I've actually gone and re-recorded that introduction in a way that I feel is more true to myself, true to the story, and more authentic. And I've just uploaded it too. And that will be now the official first episode for season two. And I don't care about the viewers lost, about the reputational damage or anything like that, that kind of it potentially could be the result of A, admitting that was crossing the line, and B, re-recording. Because when you, it was one thing to admit it in private and be like, oh, I'm sorry about that. That's a little bit funny. And then it's another thing again to say, no, I'm going to rectify that mistake. Even though it's going to cost me time, effort, energy, also make me look a certain way, also kind of solidifies it, right? It kind of concretes the fact that you did cross the line. And so I've done that, and I feel good about it. I feel really good about it. And what's been awesome is the feedback from people that I love and trust and know and respect, who have been like, good job, good work. that was the right thing to do. And partners as well, who have a financial stake in the content, come out publicly and say, awesome work. Brent, especially from My Slice of Life, thank you for your comments and your encouragement in the public space. That really means a lot. Georgie as well from Ridgeline, she was really good. She was like, I'm glad that you removed that. She didn't say anything at the time, but she was appreciated me going back and fixing it. So, yeah, that's just a small little reflection. And I want to dovetail it with this comment is that I want to encourage you to be honest and authentic, especially when it hurts, especially in the hunting realm, because we have so much going against us or that can go against us in the hunting world. We can't afford to sit in the shadows and hide. We have to be authentic. We have to be honest. We have to be open. In fact, I believe that that is the best tool in our toolkit, the best weapon in our arsenal that we can use to perpetuate, propel, encourage hunting and move it forward. In the past, I've even had experiences with this, with various people in the industry and various governing bodies and large organizations who have criticized me for being as open as I have been because they represent an old school way of thinking about this approach, a cautious approach, although somewhat reserved approach to let's not talk too much about wounding, like because it looks bad. And things of that nature. And I totally get it. I totally understand it. And I respect those people, those organizations for that stance. I think it's a well-rounded stance, but I don't think it's the right stance. I think that time has shown us and history has shown us in Australia that when we hide our skeletons in the closet because we don't think the world is ready for them, then the world can't get ready for them. They won't understand when they come out. And those skeletons always come out. And so there's some ugly things in hunting. Ugly is probably not the right word. There's things in hunting that people find hard to pass, that people find difficult to understand. Not because they're bad or wrong, but because they're different. And they're intense, like the death of an animal or wounding an animal. And what we can't afford to do is shy away from these topics, ignore these topics. It's important that we actually create content that discusses them, that shows them, not so that we can increase our liability and kind of give our critics ammunition against us, but so that people can understand the nature of what we do and why it's important, why wounding is such an important topic and why we should do everything possible to avoid wounding animals. But I believe that it's to not show an experience where an animal is wounded and it was unfortunate is not the right thing to do. Now, we don't want to show every single time that happens. Hopefully, it doesn't happen a lot to you. It certainly doesn't happen a lot to me, which is good. But if it did, you wouldn't want to kind of flog the horse and just keep trying wounding after wounding after wounding. But at the same time, you shouldn't hide from what you do. And so I guess I say all of this to encourage you to be honest, to be authentic. If you're new to hunting, it's okay to say you're new to hunting. It's okay to ask questions. You don't have to pretend to be the best shot in the world. You don't have to pretend to know all the best spots. You don't have to pretend to have, you know, shot the most animals or the biggest animal or whatever it is. There is such a need for authenticity in our community. We need more and more hunters that are authentic because they will be the champions that actually help us move forward. It will be those individuals that have standing in our community and standing outside of our community whose voices will be heard, whose wisdom will be listened to, who will help guard and safeguard legislation that protects hunting. Hiding is not going to help. Being disingenuous is not going to help. Being sensational in your content, hunting content, is not going to help. There is a number of things that we've been doing for a long time that aren't helping. What we need is positive role models, good representation, and authenticity is one of the key factors that lend itself to that kind of attitude and behavior. So that's a big rant that I was not planning on doing. But I did. I'll wrap up with just some closing thoughts about the episodes. Firstly, these episodes take a lot of work, a lot of time, a lot of money. What we're doing in the small team that we have, that's literally myself, Jesse Ray, our director of photography, who's also one of the leading editors. And then there's a few other people that are jumping in at certain points to help with like being an extra cameraman or things of that nature. But really, tiny team, small group of people trying to do a very ambitious thing. That's the summary of that dynamic. It's really important that if you believe in what I stand for, what we stand for, what we're trying to accomplish, that you help support us. And the way that you can support us is very, very simple. If you want to support us, watch the content and do all the things that people do, like liking and all that kind of stuff. But most importantly, share the content. If you really enjoy it, share it with a friend. They don't have to be a hunter. They can be a non-hunter. You can say, hey, look at this cool video. Isn't this cool? This is what Chris is trying to do. I resonate with it. This is what I'm trying to do too. Can you see? Like, look at this cool thing that he cooked. I'm trying to get into cooking, hunting food. And like, I want to learn it. And you just like use the content to start conversations and to raise awareness about what we're doing, because very much so, we are trailblazing with this content. Yes, there is existing hunting shows. There's been hunting shows that have been around for a while, and they are great. I'm a huge fan of them, but we need more of them. And this is still very much, even with those shows that have come before, there's still a lot of uncharted territory, and we're still ice breaking our way through the tundra, trying to get to the goal. And that's difficult, that's hard, that requires a lot of work, that requires a lot of money, that requires a lot of time, all of which I am committed to doing. What would help is if you would share the content. That would mean a lot. That would mean a lot to me. So that's pretty much it. They are my thoughts on season 2 of The Huntsman. I'm really enjoying it. I'm super excited. The next hunt that I mentioned next week is we're taking advantage of the rut that's happening, and we will be traveling to a pretty amazing location to get some big animals. I'm very excited about that. Not in terms of big, in terms of like buffalo size big. I'm talking about big in terms of like big heads, some pretty epic beasts. And then we're also going to be traveling. We're actually filming 2 episodes this month. So we'll be heading out to Gippsland to hunt hog deer, we're going to do a hog deer duck hunt combination, which is going to be crazy. And I'm just really, really excited about both those things. I'm excited to get back on the ducks and that we have duck season. And I'm excited to go after hog deer as well. So keep your eyes peeled. The hog deer episode, I'm not sure when that one's going to come out. We might keep that one up our sleeve once it's done, just in case something goes wrong with an episode and we need to schedule it in earlier, or it might be the season finale. I have no idea where it's going to sit in the mix in terms of the numbered episode. But yeah, that one will come out as well. And finally, I just want to thank basically you for watching, for your attention. It really means a lot that you would sit through like a long form podcast like this and listen to me just talk. Again, there's no guest here. It's not as dynamic as some other podcasts. So I really, really appreciate that. And I want to encourage you, if you are not a member of the Australian Hunters Club, I know I talk about this all the time, pretty much in every single content, but I do so because it is the main vehicle towards achieving the goal of better hunting in Australia, stronger hunting community, stronger hunting economy in Australia. And so I will 100% talk about it unashamedly at every opportunity that I've got. If you're not a member of the Australian Hunters Club, I want to encourage you to join. We are a fast growing community. There's so much value that you can get from the club. You can go in the draw to win professionally guided hunts every single month. One, sometimes two every single month. I see people that win it and I'm so encouraged by the stories that they share. You can win hunting products every month. Those things are only getting better, more and more value. We're trying to increase the licenses that we can give access to in terms of genuine reason. At the moment, you can get it in New South Wales. We're hoping to open that up to Victorians very, very soon. And then Queenslanders. Like, there's an amazing community that sits behind the club that you can engage with. We have probably, I think, the largest hunters directory in Australia that you can tap into and use to find other local members and connect with people to go hunting. You can host hunts. You can join hosted hunts. We've got our camp coming up in June, which is going to be in Queensland, outside of Toowoomba, in the most epic hunting property in Australia, Niora, with Have a Go Safaris. They are just incredible. It's going to be amazing. So I want to encourage you, if you haven't already checked it out, check out australianhunters.com.au. I would love you to join like me as a member of the club. It'd be awesome to have you in our club. Otherwise, thanks so much for watching or for listening, and I'll see you again soon.